I'll be brief. I'm Larry Moan, president of the Manhattan Institute, and I'd like to welcome you to actually the 20th anniversary of the Walter Wriston Lecture. And, you know, just sitting thinking about those 20 years, I'm glad we got the name right on this lecture, because Walter Wriston was truly a great man who believed in the power of ideas and had the courage to speak his mind. And that's really the tradition of this lecture. And we're very honored to have Dr. Leon Cass in that great tradition. So please enjoy your dinner company, and at 8:30 we'll begin our program. Thank you. Thank you all again. If you'd all be seated, I think we'll get started with the official program. If I could have your attention, please. Thank you. Thank you all again for coming. This past year has been an eventful one for the Manhattan Institute. As you all know, this year, Brian Anderson succeeded the brilliant Myron Magnet as editor of our flagship City Journal. And he has begun to add his own mark to the magazine's long tradition of excellence. Under his leadership, the journal's pages have been graced with new writers such as Pulitzer Prize winner Judith Miller, iconoclastic journalist Christopher Hitchens, and French intellectual Guy Sarmont. At the same time, the magazine has not forgotten its core mission, to tell the good news and the bad news about America's cities. The most recent issue features stories by Nicole Gelinas on the lessons of Boston's Big Dig, Heather McDonald on the reclamation of Los Angeles's Skid Row, and Alec Magnet on how Denver's new mayor has embraced broken windows policing with impressive results. We remain committed to the belief that vibrant cities are an essential part of the national fabric, and that good ideas and leadership can create that vibrancy in America's cities. In addition to his editorial leadership at City Journal, Brian is an accomplished author in his own right. His most recent book, Democratic Capitalism and Its Discontents, received a glowing review in the New York Times, which stated, quote, "To read Anderson at his luminous best is to be reminded of conservatism at its wisest." High praise indeed. Brian, please step up and take the mic. Brian Anderson. There has also been some good news on the legal reform front. The New York Times reports that doctors are returning to the state of Texas as medical malpractice reform begins to take hold. New securities lawsuits have plummeted in the wake of corruption charges against the firm that had filed the majority of them. Thanks to the scrutiny of a federal judge in Texas, fraud and asbestos cases has seen the light of day. And class action filings in so-called judicial hellholes like Madison County, Illinois, have virtually disappeared thanks to the Federal Class Action Fairness Act of 2005. Our Center for Legal Policy has provided the American public and the political leadership with a message that they're finally getting. There is a difference between the rule of law and the rule of lawyers. We're delighted this fall to welcome to our center, as a visiting scholar, one of the nation's most prolific and influential legal thinkers, Richard Epstein. Richard is one of the most frequently cited law professors in the country, and his writings span a broad array of fields, from property rights to product liability to healthcare. An exciting addition to our program. Richard, wherever you are, just please get up briefly, take a bow. All right, you're up and down. And finally, David Brooks wrote recently in the New York Times that healthcare is the issue that will redefine the role of government in the 21st century. We believe David is right. And the Manhattan Institute scholars are working hard to move that debate in the right direction. This year, we released Regina Herzlinger's book, Who Killed Healthcare, in which she argues that consumer sovereignty and innovative entrepreneurship can create the kind of quality healthcare that all Americans both deserve and need. And just yesterday, senior fellow Ben Zeiker released an Institute study that debunks the notion that savings from a single-payer healthcare system is the solution to our current runaway costs. Ben's study established once again that all free lunches are based upon false accounting. Ben is here tonight. Please join me in congratulating him on his important work. And finally, I refer you back once again to the current issue of City Journal, in which Peter Huber has a remarkable article on the miracle drugs that will soon be coming online and how that will inevitably lead to the end of one-size-fits-all healthcare. So through paradigm-shifting books, empirically grounded research, and elegantly written articles, the Manhattan Institute continues to make the case for economic and individual liberty, the rule of law, and safe and prosperous cities. I want to thank you all here as our supporters who made that work possible. And now I turn the proceedings over to Neil Cozadoy, the editor of Commentary Magazine, who will introduce our 2007 Risten lecturer, Dr. Leon Kass. As you all know, Neil has been with Commentary since 1966, and in 1995 succeeded Norman Pothoritz to become only the third editor in the magazine's long history. It has to be tough replacing a living legend, but Neil Cozadoy handled the transition with ease, and Commentary's reputation, prestige, and influence have only grown during his tenure as editor. It was announced just this week that coming on January 2009, Neil will be stepping down as editor and handing the reins over to John Pothoritz. I was pleased to learn, however, that Neil intends to remain actively involved with Commentary, which has been his intellectual home for more than 40 years. Please join me in welcoming Neil Cozadoy and thanking him for his past, present, and future contributions to the world of ideas.
I could not be more thrilled or pleased by the choice of my successor. And like a good Jewish father, I live in hopes and in every confidence of being greatly surpassed by him. And I think I've just given myself a transition to what I really want to say. I wonder how many of you know the one about the two Jewish gentlemen who met on the street in Warsaw in the mid-1920s. And just as the latest marvel of modern technology was sweeping the continent of Europe. "Shmulik," says the one to the other, "you study science. This radio, you understand this radio and how it works?" Of course, says Shmulik. See, you've got wireless signals, you've got the modulation of electromagnetic waves. No, this is not getting through, even to himself. So let me see, how can I explain this to you? Let me draw you a picture. Imagine a dog. The dog, a big dog. A really, really big dog. This dog is so big that the tail of this dog is in Moscow. The head of this dog is in Paris. You pull on the dog's tail in Moscow, and in Paris, the dog barks. His friend says, okay, I get it, but what does this have to do? Wait. Okay, now, take away the dog. If I'm not mistaken, this joke was first told to me by the famously dour and severe scholar who will soon be addressing you from this podium. I share it with you partly as evidence of a side of him, the impish side, that is seldom on public display, though I'm told by him that you may get a taste of it tonight if you're very good. But in larger part, I share it because this dog and his very shaggy tail have a special relevance to one of the major themes of Leon Kass's thought and writings. And that theme is the insufficiency of science and of the scientific worldview to account either for our human nature or our human experience of reality, and not even our experience of those real-world wonders, like radio, that the scientific mind has itself conceived and brought into being. How much less so I might add, has the purely scientific apprehension proved sufficient to account for the comic imagination that would make up so deep and silly a joke, let alone for the possibility that an audience would find it funny enough to laugh at. But I'm getting ahead of where I should be. Leon Cass was born and raised in Chicago and received his undergraduate education at the University of Chicago. He went on to complete an MD degree at that university's medical school and a PhD in biochemistry at Harvard. By the mid-1970s, he had returned to teach both undergraduate and graduate students at the University of Chicago, and he was there to stay. He is today the Addie Clark Harding Professor in the University's Committee on Social Thought, while also serving at the American Enterprise Institute as the Hertog Fellow in Social Thought. These days, of course, Leon Cass is best known for his controversial, to say the least, service as chairman of the President's Council on Bioethics, which is another way of saying that he is best known for his passionate interest in, and or rather his passionate concern over, the ethical dilemmas posed by contemporary advances in medical and laboratory science, especially as these touch upon the beginning and the end of life. With him, this concern goes back very far and seems to have been fully developed as long ago as the late 1960s when he joined the Hastings Center, the pioneering bioethics research institute. Since then, and throughout his long tenure at Chicago, in his many books, in essays and commentary and elsewhere, and in his public service, he has grappled incessantly with the issues raised by modern medical and genetic technology, from in vitro fertilization and cloning to stem cell therapy, the treatment of the aged and the helpless, organ transplantation, assisted suicide and euthanasia, and the shifting mores and ethos of the medical profession itself. He's grappled with these issues. More to the point, and with tremendous seriousness and courage, he has grappled with the human meaning of these issues and with the human dilemmas that they raise. What attitude should we adopt toward the medical advances I've named and their potential consequences for the relief of man's estate, or for man's estate, period? What do our heated debates over stem cell therapy and cloning and assisted suicide and all the rest tell us about ourselves and about our culture, about our bedrock beliefs concerning who we are and what is our purpose on earth, if any, and what are our limits as mortal beings? In short, all the hard, permanent questions of existence that contemporary science, in its miraculously fertile and propulsive push forward, has made it more urgent than ever for us to address, not least because so many in the name of science have promised to answer these questions for us and without us. To the unenviable and far from popular task of confronting these issues head on, Leon Cass has brought a wide-ranging scientific expertise, a long and thorough steeping in the great works of our philosophical, literary, and religious heritage, an unfooled alertness to the waywardness of human desires, along with a set of tested convictions about the aspirations of the human soul, a sure mastery of the ways and the nuances of reasoned argument, and most confounding of all, he has brought a stubborn, unadorned, easily aroused sense of plain, old-fashioned wonder at the simple fact that we human beings, made up of material stuff and electrochemical processes like every other living thing on Earth, nevertheless speak and create, plan, speculate, hunger and regret, that we judge, that we hope, that we love, and that all this makes all the difference. As I've just suggested, Leon Cass is not exactly the most popular voice of our time. In his post as chairman of the President's Council, of which he is still a member, he was rather denounced as a public danger, as someone devoted to turning back the clock of scientific progress and depriving us of its benefits, as a running dog of the religious right, as the vanguard of an American Taliban. Well, he is the Hertog Fellow, after all. In any case, The smears go with the territory, as others who have gone to Washington to serve their country will testify. Nor can someone who has spent time, as much time as Leon has, on a university faculty have been surprised to discover that in the nation's capital, too, politics ain't beanball. The reason academic politics are so vicious, Henry Kissinger once conjectured, is that so little is at stake. Leon Cass has been in the academy and out of the academy, and even from within the belly of that beast, he has, however perilously, insisted on raising his dissenting voice on matters of public moment. He doesn't scare easily. For him, truly, everything about the human future is at stake. Maybe not always, and not always immediately, but often enough, and usually sooner than we like to think. About this, he is undoubtedly right. And that is only one reason why his lion-hearted and tender-souled defense of our civilization and our species is one of the glories of the age. Leon Cass.
Neil is my editor, and you can see why my articles are tolerably good. It is a deep honor for me to be invited to give the Wriston Lecture at the Manhattan Institute. I have, for many years from afar, been a great admirer of the Manhattan Institute, its scholarship. I've admired its intellectual rigor, its moral courage, and its enormous good sense. And I'd like to express my gratitude to the Manhattan Institute and to the board for this honor, and thank you all for coming. The title of this talk, Keeping Life Human, Science, Religion, and the Soul, in 30 minutes. Two old-timers, Max and Jake, spend every hour of their retirement imagining and debating what life is like in the world to come. Eager for the answer, they make a pledge that whoever goes first will somehow find a way quickly to communicate the news to his surviving friend. After several years of such debates, Max dies, and Jake promptly takes up his post at the phone. A day passes, a week, a month, 6 months, no Max. Just as Jake is beginning to despair, maybe there is no world to come, the phone rings. Hello, Jake, it's Max. Max, where in hell have you been? I've been worried sick. I'm really sorry, Jake, but I had a devil of a time getting to a phone. Well, never mind. Max, tell me, what is it really like? He says, all right. He says, I'll tell you. First of all, I get a good night's sleep, 11, 12 hours. I get up at sunrise. I stretch a little. I perform my ablutions. I take a little walk. I eat a good breakfast. After breakfast, I relax a little, I take a constitutional, I admire the scenery. Before you know it, it's time for lunch. Lunch is delicious, but very filling. So after lunch, I take a little nap. I get up refreshed. I wander down to the lake. I take a little dip. I have a little sex. Before you know it, it's time for supper. I have a little supper, I take a little stroll, I enjoy the sunset, and then I sleep 12 hours. Max, it sounds like Miami. It sure don't sound like heaven. Heaven? Jake, who said heaven? I'm in Montana. I'm a buffalo. That's it. It's heavy from here on in. Keeping life human these days is no laughing matter. Among the contemporary challenges to our humanity, the deepest ones come from a most unlikely quarter, our wonderful and humane biomedical science and technology. The powers they are providing for altering the workings of our bodies and minds are already being used for purposes beyond therapy and may soon be used to transform human nature itself. In our lifetime, the natural relations between sex and procreation, personal identity and embodiment, and human agency and human achievement have all been profoundly altered by new biomedical technologies. The pill, in vitro fertilization, surrogate wombs, cloning, genetic engineering, organ swapping, mechanical spare parts, performance-enhancing drugs, computer implants into brains, Ritalin for the young, Viagra for the old, Prozac for everyone. Virtually unnoticed, the train to Huxley's dehumanized Brave New World has already left the station. But beneath the weighty ethical concerns raised by these new biotechnologies, a subject for a different lecture, lies a deeper philosophical challenge, one that threatens how we think about who and what we are. Scientific ideas and discoveries about living nature and man, perfectly welcome and harmless in themselves, are being enlisted to do battle against our traditional religious and moral teachings, and even our self-understanding as creatures of freedom and dignity. A quasi-religious faith has sprung up among us. Let me call it soulless scientism, which believes that our new biology, eliminating all mystery, can provide a complete account of all human life, giving purely scientific explanations for human thought, love, creativity, moral judgment, and even why we believe in God. The threat to our humanity today comes not from the transmigration of souls in the next life, but from the denial of soul in this one. Not from turning men into buffaloes, but from denying that there is any real difference between them. Make no mistake, the stakes in this contest are high. At issue are the moral and spiritual health of our nation, the continued vitality of science, and our own self-understanding as human beings and as children of the West. All friends of human freedom and dignity, including even the atheists among us, must understand that their own humanity is on the line. Tonight, I wish to offer an overview of the danger and to suggest how it can be countered. I will first describe the threat scientism poses both to human self-understanding and to ethics. I will then identify philosophical and religious resources available for meeting the challenge. We need first to distinguish the grandiose faith of contemporary scientism from modern science as such, which began as a more modest enterprise. Although the founders of modern science sought certain knowledge useful for life, obtainable using new concepts and methods, they understood that science would never offer complete and absolute knowledge of the whole of human life, for example, of thought, feeling, morality, or faith. For they understood, as we tend to forget, that the rationality of science is but a partial and highly specialized rationality, concocted for the purpose of gaining only that kind of knowledge for which it was devised, and applicable to only those aspects of the world that can be captured by science's abstract notions. The peculiar reason of science is not, nor was meant to be, the natural reason of everyday life and human experience. Neither is it the reason of philosophy or religious thought. Thus, science does not seek to know beings or their natures, but only the regularities of the changes they undergo. Science seeks to know only how things work, not what things are and why. Science gives the histories of things, but not their aspirations or purposes. Science quantifies certain external relations of one object to another, but it can say nothing at all about their inner states of being, not only for human beings, but for any living creature. Science can often predict what will happen if certain perturbations occur, but it eschews explanations in terms of causes, especially of ultimate causes. In a word, our remarkable science of nature has made enormous progress precisely by its decision to ignore the larger perennial human questions about being, cause, purpose, inwardness, hierarchy, and the goodness or badness of things, questions that science happily gave over to philosophy, poetry, and religion. Thus, in cosmology, for example, we have wonderful progress in characterizing the temporal beginnings as a Big Bang and elaborate calculations to describe what happened next. But science preserves complete silence regarding the status quo ante and the ultimate cause. Unlike a normally curious child, Cosmologists do not ask what was before the Big Bang or why is there something rather than nothing, because the answer must be an exasperated God only knows. In genetics, we have the complete DNA sequence of several organisms, including man, and we are rapidly learning what many of these genes do. But this analytic approach cannot tell us how the life of a buffalo differs from that of a butterfly, or even for what accounts for the special unity and active wholeness of butterflies and buffaloes, and the purposive efforts they make to preserve their own specific integrity. In neurophysiology, we know vast amounts about the processing of visual stimuli, their transformation into electrochemical signals, and the mechanisms for transmitting these signals to the brain. But sight itself, we know not through science, but only from the inside, and then only because we are not blind. The eyeball and the brain are material objects, take up space, can be held in the hand. But neither the capacity of sight and intellect, nor the activities of seeing and thinking take up space, can be held. Although absolutely dependent on material conditions, they are in their essence immaterial. They are capacities and activities of soul, hence not an object of knowledge for a materialist science. Among many biologists today, these important limitations of science are largely forgotten, as is the modesty that they should induce. Instead, bioprophets of scientism exploiting powerful ideas from genetics, developmental biology, neuroscience, and evolutionary psychology issue bold challenges to traditional understandings of human nature, human life, and human dignity. Already Darwinism, in its original version 150 years ago, appeared to challenge our special standing. How could any being descended from subhuman origins rather than created directly by the hand of God claim to be a higher animal, never mind a godlike one? Indeed, evolutionary theory denies that animals should be called higher and lower rather than just more or less complex. After all animals are finally in the same business, individual survival for the sake of perpetuating their genes, and therefore the apparent differences among them are at bottom merely more or less complicated ways of getting the same job done. The new materialistic explanations of vital, even psychic, events leave no room for soul, understood as life's animating principle. Genes are said to determine temperament and character. Mechanistic accounts of brain functions seem to do away with the need to speak of human freedom and purposiveness. Brain imaging studies claim to explain how we make moral judgments. A fully exterior account of our behavior, the grail of neuroscience, diminishes the significance of our felt inwardness. Feeling, passion, awareness, imagination, desire, love, hate, and thought are, scientifically speaking, merely brain events. There are even reports of a God module in the brain whose activity is thought to explain religious or mystical experiences. Never mind created in the image of God, what elevated humanistic views of human life or human goodness is defensible against the belief trumpeted by biology's most public and prophetic voices that man is just a collection of molecules, an accident on the stage of evolution, a freakish speck of mind in a mindless universe, fundamentally no different from other living things? What chance have our treasured ideas of freedom and dignity against the reductive notion of the selfish gene, or the belief that DNA is the essence of life, or the teaching that all human behavior and our rich inner life are rendered intelligible only in terms of neurochemistry and their contributions to reproductive success? Many of our leading scientists and intellectuals, truth to tell, are eager to dethrone traditional understandings of man's special place in the whole, and they use every available opportunity to do battle. For example, consider how the luminaries of the International Academy of Humanism, including biologists Francis Crick and E.O. Wilson, and humanists Isaiah Berlin and Kurt Vonnegut, chose to defend human cloning. I quote, "What moral issues would human cloning raise? Some world religions teach that human beings are fundamentally different from other animals, that humans have been imbued by a deity with immortal souls, giving them a value that cannot be compared to that of other living things. Human nature is held to be unique and sacred. Scientific advances which pose a perceived risk of altering this nature are strongly opposed. But as far as the scientific enterprise can determine, human capabilities appear to differ in degree, not in kind, from those found among higher animals. Humanity's rich repertoire of thoughts, feelings, aspirations, and hopes seem to arise from electrochemical brain processes, not from an immaterial soul that operates in ways no instrument can discover. Views of human nature rooted in humanity's tribal past ought not to be our primary criterion for making moral decisions about cloning. The potential benefits of cloning may be so immense that it would be a tragedy if ancient theological scruples should lead to a Luddite rejection of cloning, end of quote. Notice that in order to justify ongoing research, these humanists are willing to shed not only traditional religious views, but any view of human distinctiveness and special dignity, their own included. They fail to see that the scientific view of man they celebrate does more than insult our vanity. It undermines our self-conception as free, thoughtful, and responsible beings, worthy of respect because we alone among the animals have minds and hearts that aim far higher than the mere perpetuation of our genes. The problem, to repeat, lies not so much with the scientific findings themselves, but with the shallow philosophy that recognizes no truths but these. Here, for example, is evolutionary psychologist and popularizer Steven Pinker railing against any appeal to the human soul. I quote, "Unfortunately for that theory, brain science has shown that the mind is what the brain does. The supposedly immaterial soul can be bisected with a knife, altered by chemicals, turned on or off by electricity, and extinguished by a sharp blow or lack of oxygen. Centuries ago, it was unwise to ground morality on the dogma that the earth sat at the center of the universe. It is just as unwise today to ground it on dogmas about souls endowed by God." End of quote. Without irony, Pinker, a psychologist, denies the existence of the psyche. Yet he is ignorant of the fact that soul need not be conceived as a ghost in the machine or as a separate thing that survives the body, but can be understood instead as the integrated powers of the naturally organic body, the ground and source of awareness, appetite, and action. He does not understand that the vital powers of an organism do not reside in the materials of the organism, but emerge only when the materials are formed and organized in a particular way. He does not understand that the empowering organization of materials, the vital form or soul, is not itself material. There is, of course, nothing novel about reductionism, materialism, and determinism of the sort displayed here. These are doctrines with which Socrates contended long ago. What is new is that these philosophies seem to be vindicated by scientific advance. Here, in consequence, would be the most pernicious result of our new biology, more dehumanizing than any actual technological manipulations, present or future. The erosion, perhaps the final erosion, of the idea of man as noble, dignified, precious, or godlike, and its replacement with a view of man no less than of nature as mere raw material for manipulation and homogenization. The new scientism not only banishes soul from its account of life, it soullessly neglects the ethical and spiritual aspects and aspirations of the human animal. For we alone among the animals go in for ethicizing, for concerning ourselves with how to live. We alone among the animals ask not only what can I know, but also what ought I do and what may I hope. Science, notwithstanding its great gifts to human life in the form of greater comfort, health, and safety, is utterly unhelpful in satisfying these great longings of the human soul. Now, science by design is notoriously morally neutral, silent on the distinction between better and worse, right and wrong, the noble and the base. And although scientists hope that the uses that will be made of their findings will be, as Francis Bacon prophesied, governed in charity, science can do nothing to ensure that result. It can offer no standards to guide the use of the awesome powers it places in human hands. Though it seeks universal knowledge, it has no answer to moral relativism. It knows not what charity is, what charity requires, or even whether and why it is good. What then will remain for us, morally and spiritually, should soulless scientism succeed in its efforts to overthrow our traditional religions, our inherited views of human life, and the moral teachings that depend on them? Nowhere will this deficiency be more readily felt than with regard to the proposed uses of biotechnical power for purposes beyond the cure of disease and the relief of suffering. We are today promised better children, superior performance, ageless bodies, and happy souls, all with the help of the biotechnologies of enhancement. Bioprophets tell us that we are en route to a new stage of evolution, to the creation of a post-human society, a society based on science and built by technology, a society in which traditional teachings about human nature will be passé, and religious teachings about how to live will all be irrelevant. But what, I ask you, will guide this evolution? How do we know whether any of these so-called enhancements is in fact an improvement? Why ought any human being embrace a post-human future? Scientism has no answer to these critical moral questions. Deaf to nature, to God, and even to moral reason, it can offer no standards for judging change to be progress or for judging anything else. Instead, it tacitly preaches its own version of faith, hope, and charity. Faith in the goodness of scientific progress, hope in the promise of overcoming our biological limitations, charity in promising everyone ultimate relief from and transcendence of the human condition. No religious faith rests on flimsier ground. So this is our peculiar moral and religious crisis. We are in turbulent seas without a landmark, precisely because we adhere more and more to a view of human life that both gives us enormous power and that at the same time denies every possibility of non-arbitrary standards for guiding its use. Though well-equipped, we know not who we are nor where we are going. Engineering the engineer as well as the engine, we race our train, we know not where. Will we be able to combat the dehumanizing teachings and moral bankruptcy of soulless scientism? As a cultural matter, it is difficult to predict. But we are not, I am happy to say, intellectually or spiritually resourceless. On the contrary, we have good philosophical arguments to rebut the soulless teachings of scientism and ennobling scriptural truths to nourish the human soul. Together, they make possible a human defense of the human. Let me offer a few elements of such a defense, starting on the philosophical side. First, despite what scientism says, our evolutionary origins do not refute the truth of our human distinctiveness. The history of how we came to be is no substitute for knowing directly the being that has come. To know man, we must study him as he is and through what he does, not how he got to be this way. For understanding our nature, what we are, or our standing in the world, it matters not whether our origin was from the primordial slime or from the hand of a creator God. Even with monkeys for ancestors, what has emerged is more than monkey business. Second, regarding our inwardness, freedom, and purposiveness, we must repair to our inside knowledge. For even if scientists were to prove to their satisfaction that inwardness, consciousness, and human will or intention were all illusory, at best epiphenomena of brain events, or that what we call loving and wishing and thinking are merely electrochemical transformations of brain substance, we should proceed to ignore them, and for good reason. Life's self-revelatory testimony to the living regarding its own vital activity is more immediate, compelling, and trustworthy than are the abstracted scientific explanations that evaporate lived experience by identifying it with some correlated bodily event. The most unsophisticated child knows red and blue more reliably than a blind physicist with his spectrometers. And anyone who has ever loved knows that love cannot be reduced to neurotransmitters. Third, we can point out that truth and error, no less than human freedom and dignity, become empty notions when the soul is reduced to chemicals. Even science itself becomes impossible, because the very possibility of science depends on the immateriality of thought and on the mind's independence from the bombardment of matter. Otherwise, there is no truth. There is only, it seems to me. Not only the possibility for recognizing truth and error, but also the reasons for doing science rest on a picture of human freedom and dignity that science itself cannot recognize. Wonder, curiosity, a wish not to be self-deceived, and a spirit of philanthropy are the sine qua non of the modern scientific enterprise. They are the hallmarks of the living human soul, not of the anatomized brain. A philosophical critique of scientism may give us back our souls and restore the human difference. But philosophy alone cannot answer the longings of our soul or supply its quest for meaning. For such nourishment, we must turn to other sources, including especially the Bible. The Bible offers a profound teaching on human nature, but unlike science, it locates that teaching in relation to the deepest human longings and concerns. For various reasons, we should turn first to the Bible's majestic beginning, the story of the creation in Genesis 1, which not surprisingly is the chief target of our soulless scientism. Elsewhere, I have argued that the teachings of Genesis 1 are in fact untouched by the scientific findings that allegedly make them plumb unbelievable. For Genesis 1 is not a freestanding historical or scientific account of what happened and how, but rather an awe-inspiring prelude to a lengthy and comprehensive teaching about how we are to live. The Bible addresses us not as detached, rational observers moved primarily by curiosity, but as existentially engaged human beings who need first and foremost to make sense of their world and their task within it. The first human question is not, how did this come into being, or how does this work? The first human question is, what does all this mean? And especially, what am I to do here? The biblical account of creation begins to nourish the soul's deep longings for answers to these questions. The world that you see around you, you human being, we are told, is orderly and intelligible, an articulated whole comprising distinct kinds. The order of the world is as rational as the speech that you use to describe it, and that right before your reading eyes summoned it into being. Most importantly, this intelligible order of creatures means mainly to demonstrate that contrary to the belief of uninstructed human experience, the sun, the moon, and the stars are not divine, despite their sempiternal beauty and power and their majestic, perfect motion. Moreover, being is hierarchic, and man is the highest among the creatures, higher than the heavens. Man alone is a being that is in the image of God. What does this mean, and can it be true? In the course of recounting his creation, Genesis 1 introduces us to God's activities and powers. God speaks, commands, names, blesses, and hallows. God makes and makes freely. God looks at and beholds the world. God is concerned with the goodness of things. God addresses solicitously other living creatures and provides for their sustenance. In short, according to Genesis 1, God exercises speech and reason, freedom in doing and making, and the powers of contemplation, judgment, and care. Doubters may wonder whether this is truly the case about God. After all, it is only on biblical authority that we regard God as possessing these powers and these activities. But it is indubitably clear, even to atheists, that we human beings have them, and that they lift us above the plane of a merely animal existence. Human beings alone among the creatures speak, plan, create, contemplate, and judge. Human beings alone among the creatures can articulate a future goal and use that plan to guide them in bringing it into being. Human beings alone among the creatures can think about the whole, marvel at its many splendored forms, wonder about its beginning, and feel awe in beholding its grandeur and in pondering the mystery of its source. Please note, these self-evident truths do not rest on biblical authority. Rather, the biblical text enables us to confirm them by an act of self-reflection. Our reading of this text, addressable and intelligible only to us human beings, and our responses to it, possible only for us human beings, provide all the proof we need to confirm the text's assertion of our superior standing. This is not anthropocentric prejudice. This is cosmological truth. And nothing we shall ever learn from science about how we came to be this way could ever make it false. In addition to holding up a mirror in which we can see reflected our special standing in the world, Genesis 1 teaches truly the bounty of the universe and its hospitality in supporting terrestrial life. Moreover, we have it on the highest authority that the whole, the being of all that is very good. Quote, "And God saw everything that he had made, and behold, it was very good." The Bible here teaches a truth that cannot be known by science, even as it is the basis of the very possibility of science and of everything else we esteem. For it truly is very good that there is something rather than nothing. It truly is very good that this something is intelligibly ordered rather than dark and chaotic. It truly is very good that the whole contains a being who can not only discern the intelligible order, but who can recognize that it is very good, who can appreciate that there is something rather than nothing, and that he exists with the reflexive capacity to celebrate these facts with the mysterious source of being itself. As Abraham Joshua Heschel put it, I quote, "The biblical words about the genesis of heaven and earth are not words of information, but words of appreciation. The story of creation is not a description of how the world came into being, but a song about the glory of the world's having come into being. And God saw that it was good," unquote. There is more. The purpose of the song is not only to celebrate, it is also to summon us to awe and attention. For just as the world as created is a world summoned into existence under command, so to be a human being in that world is to live in search of a summons. It is to recognize, first of all, that we are here not by choice or on account of merit, but as an undeserved gift from powers not at our disposal. It is to feel the need to justify that gift, to make something out of our indebtedness for the opportunity of existence. It is to stand in the world not only in awe of the world's existence, but under an obligation to answer a call to a worthy life, a life of meaning, a life that does honor to the divine likeness with which our otherwise animal existence has been, no thanks to us, endowed. It is explicitly to feel the need to find a way of life for which we should be pleased to answer at the bar of justice when our course is run, in order to vindicate the blessed opportunity and the moral spiritual challenge that is the true essence of being human. The first chapter of Genesis, like no work of science, no matter how elegant or profound, invites us to hearken to a transcendent voice. It answers to the human need to know not only how the world works, but also what we are to do here. It is the beginning of a Bible-length response to the human longing for meaning and wholehearted existence. The truth it bespeaks are more than cognitive. They point away from mere truths of belief to the truths of life in action, of song and praise and ritual, of love and procreation and civic life, of responsible deeds in answering the call to righteousness, holiness, and love of neighbor. Such truths speak more deeply and permanently to the souls of men than any mere doctrine, whether of science or even of faith. As long as we understand our great religions as the embodiments of such truths, we friends of religion will have nothing to fear from science, and we friends of science who are still in touch with our humanity will have nothing to fear from religion. Like Max and Jake, I have no knowledge about the world to come. Unlike Max and Jake, I've never given it more than a moment's thought. For whatever might be the fate of our souls when Act 5 is over, it is the pursuit of their well-being here and now while the show is still running that is, in my opinion, the crucial human task, yesterday, today, always. Regarding this truth and this work, the soulless teachings of science or scientism should never leave us buffaloed. Thank you very much.
I think we have time for one or two quick questions, which, you know, if the audience wants it, I'll give you the opportunity. We have two mics, so just raise your hand. We'll try to acknowledge you.
Could they turn the lights up so I can see the faces?
Can we turn the lights up?
A little bit, so I'd like to see the faces of...
The gentleman over here?
Good evening, Dr. Kass. Thank you for a brilliant elocution. I'm visiting from San Francisco, and I work in venture capital, and a lot of my friends and peers in that sort of go-go scientific world are getting very interested in a whole new world, sort of Huxleyan, as you've said, about life extension to hundreds or even post-thousand-year-old human beings. And they talk about it in very serious scientific possibilities. And I'm curious if you'd talk to us a little bit, maybe in a short time, about what you think about if that's a good idea, and how we should think about it, because the scientific possibilities are actually coming faster than we many of us think.
Thank you. This is something on which I have written. Actually, there's an essay that was in First Things called L'Chaim and Its Limits. I am not as generally characterized a friend of premature death, But I don't think that, and it is my profound hope that thanks to medical progress, everyone will be enabled to live out the natural human lifespan of, we now have to say 4 score and 10, and if by reason of strength, 5 score. But beyond that, I think this is a bad idea, but probably unstoppable. I mean, the arguments are long and complicated. The social consequences are, I think, very easy to worry about. But the real question is whether or not the recognition of the limit on our time and the notion that we go around only once is the condition of the possibility of making the most of this time. That part of the argument would be that mortality is what makes life matter. And also, I wonder whether a culture that is obsessed with prolonging longevity for ourselves can really properly prepare the next generation whose existence in one's house is in fact the proof that one is perishable and that one has to make way for them. So, I mean, this would be a long discussion. I think it's not going to be sold as the immortality pill. It's going to be sold as a way of keeping octogenarians from suffering arthritis and premature dementia, and we're all going to be for it. But the things that will bring those things about are very likely also going to be have an effect on the maximum human lifespan. I don't know that there are very many people who've offered the opportunity of extending it, wouldn't jump at it, but I think this would be a mistake. I've argued about it in print. I've convinced myself on the subject. As I'm getting older, I'm not sure that I've convinced myself with respect to the mortality of those that I love. So it's a hard subject.
Maybe one more quick question. Anybody in here? No, Heather, okay.
Thank you. I don't recognize the extraordinarily interesting work that's being done in neurology, looking at the science of consciousness in your description of a strong dichotomy between the conception of the soul on the one hand and scientific investigations into self-consciousness. I think they're much more compatible than you make them out to be. But in any case, the nice thing about science is that it's empirical and tests its hypotheses. So if you have confidence in your ideas of the soul, I don't see how they are necessarily at risk from a careful scientific research into how consciousness is formed.
Was the question audible? It's a long subject and a very welcome question. I'll just try to say a few things. First of all, there's an opportunity to say something about the suggestion that science is empirical. Science is empirical in a very funny sense. Empirical is a word that means related to experience. Science is empirical in the sense that it produces a kind of new experience which is not like any experience any of us experience. It's through various kinds of gadgets and pointer readings. And it's great power, and this is a kind of mystery, even a miracle, that by abstracting from real experience and going to work in this kind of pseudo-experience of concepts that are not somehow true to life as lived, it manages to learn all kinds of things about how things work, which then affect life as it is lived. So part of what I'm saying is that you say science is going to do all kinds of, might do certain things to explain, to work on consciousness. Science couldn't possibly know what consciousness is if the people who were doing it didn't have some experience of consciousness, not as scientists, but as human beings in the same way you and I are now speaking. And I welcome all of these neurological studies. I mean, I think this is very exciting. But one should not mistake, one should not call the brain events that science is going to disclose as somehow explaining consciousness, because the two things are incommunicable matters. I did say something about sort of sight and intellect. These things we know only from the inside, and the scientists in a way cheat when they say they're offering an explanation. They're holding on this side things that they know from human experience. They've got these kind of correlative things here. The modest ones will say they have the material conditions of this and they won't make any large claims. The ones who I'm talking about here aren't modest at all, and they think that they have, they think they've given a full and complete account of phenomena that I want to see. We know best as living, breathing, thinking, feeling, loving human beings. And if you want to know, my thesis advisor in biochemistry, a Nobel laureate, told me when I was still in the lab, Leon, he said, human love is soon going to have a biochemical explanation. I would say, if you want to know about human love, read Dante and Shakespeare, and let the scientists do what they want to do, but they will not understand what we know experientially and what we can learn from the people who've reflected on it as it's experienced.
I'm really sorry we've run out of time, but thank you all for coming. Thank you for coming.